When Richard Thaler was in grad school, he had this economics professor who was also a wine collector.
But he had a firm rule that he wouldn't pay more than $30 for a bottle of wine.
This professor would sometimes buy bottles of wine and then store them for decades. And at some point, Thaler found out that in this collection were a few bottles the professor bought for like 10 bucks, and they had aged into beauties, into $100 bottles of wine.
And in fact, there was a wine store in town that was happy to buy his old, well-preserved bottles.
But the professor would not sell those old, well-preserved $100 bottles. He saved them to drink himself on special occasions.
Which sounds reasonable enough, but given the professor's refusal to spend more than $30 on a bottle of wine, it didn't make sense to Richard Thaler. It seemed like a violation of basic economic rules.
If you're not willing to pay $100 to buy a bottle of wine, then you should sell it rather than drink it.
Because when he's drinking a bottle of wine that costs $100, he's effectively saying, I'm not going to sell this and get $100. I'm going to drink it.
Exactly.
He's effectively paying $100 to drink it.
Exactly.
Richard Thaler became obsessed with these kinds of stories where people are violating the basic rules of economics. And so he started keeping a list of them on the chalkboard in his office.
The list is sort of dumb stuff people do.
Like, for example, when people want fewer choices rather than more. Or when they go to a movie and know 10 minutes in that it's going to be awful, but then they sit through the whole thing just because they paid for the tickets.
Thaler got pretty excited about this list, and he even at some point showed it to his dissertation advisor.
He didn't much like it. and he never did, actually.
The New York Times later reported that the advisor thought Thaler had wasted a promising career. Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm Kenny Malone. Today on the show, how Richard Thaler went beyond that list, helped save us from ourselves, and won this year's Nobel Prize in Economics.
It's like a nerd superhero origin story.
Support for Planet Money and the following message come from Betterment. They want to know, are you getting as much as you can from your investments? Betterment is the largest independent online financial advisor, and they now offer a free investment review, which helps you assess your investment accounts, tax strategies, fees, and risk exposure. See what you're doing well and how you could improve with Betterment. No sign-up required. Visit betterment.com/planetmoney to start your free 5-minute investment review today.
Richard Thaler got his PhD from the University of Rochester and took a job there as an assistant professor of economics.
So I'm teaching there and kind of floundering a bit. I was writing papers on the economics of crime and things like that. And, you know, I had this sideline, but nobody really took it seriously.
And by sideline, he means that list on the chalkboard, which had turned into a sort of obsession for Thaler. Analyzing ways people behave irrationally.
When he'd talk about this list to other economists, they'd say,
Yeah. We know lots of people are dumb.
But the economists would say, if you put everybody, you know, in a pot and stir them around, overall, on average, they're going to be rational. And this is a core assumption of economics. People, on average, behave rationally. The models that economists build, the predictions they make, are based largely on this assumption.
And then one day, Richard Thaler meets this other young academic, a psychologist. And Thaler starts telling him about his list. And the guy says, oh, you know what? You should check out this research by these two guys I used to work with in Israel, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky.
So Thaler walks over to the library.
And I had to find a whole new section of the library, the psychology section.
And he starts pulling down these papers by Kahneman and Tversky.
And I got very, very excited. I'm like racing through one paper after another. It's like watching a thriller on with a big screen.
And just to remind everyone, you're reading psychology papers.
I'm reading psychology papers and my heart is beating. It's the most excitement I've ever felt as a scientist.
Really? Is that still true? Is that still true now?
Yeah. Yeah. That was like the big light bulb going off.
Here's what that light bulb was. Kahneman and Tversky were proving that there were all of these ways where people are predictably consistently irrational.
Yeah, like you could take more or less everybody in the world, put them in a pot, stir them up. And these guys were finding people do not behave rationally on average. They were finding that people make the same kinds of mistakes over and over and over.
It starts to dawn on Thaler that he's been making this list of, like, random, cute stories of people doing weird things. But here are two psychologists who are doing actual science about those same kinds of things.
I mean, is there some sense of, like, I'm not alone in this?
Well, there was that. Although these two guys are over in Jerusalem.
So you're still kind of alone?
I'm pretty alone. You know, that's a long way from Rochester.
But shortly after this, Thaler found out that Kahneman and Tversky were scheduled to be in California at Stanford University for 1 year.
And I decided to just bet my entire life on this and flew out to Stanford, spent a few days sort of begging anyone to give me a visiting position so that I could be there when my heroes arrived and meet them and talk to them and learn stuff.
He gets a 1 year gig at Stanford, meets Kahneman and Tversky, and everything clicks.
So I was teaching them economics and they were teaching me psychology. And, you know, 40 years later, Danny Kahneman is still my best friend.
This work that Kahneman and Tversky and Thaler start doing, trying to understand the ways in which people are consistently, predictably irrational, it comes to be known as behavioral economics.
It's economics with real people.
With Kahneman and Tversky's help, Thaler is now able to start pulling down those little anecdotes from his list and test them and say, okay, is this just a cute little thing I noticed, or is this one of those things that we are predictably irrational about?
One of the famous studies they do together, Kahneman and Thaler and one other researcher do this one, is about mugs.
Mugs, as in the thing you drink coffee out of.
So they walk into class one day and they just give mugs to half of the students in the class.
There were 44 students, so 22 mugs.
Not special mugs. These were just things that Richard Thaler picked up at the student union. And then they told the students who got a mug, this is yours to keep. If you want it, you can have it. But you are also allowed to sell it to one of the other students who did not get a mug.
And they basically just said, like, ready, set, go. You know, have your market. You all have money. Some of you guys have mugs. Buy it or sell it. Do whatever you want.
And what they found was that people who did not get a mug tended to offer, like, $2 or $3.
And the people who had the mugs were like, are you kidding me? You're offering me $2 for this? I would not sell it for a penny less than $5. And remember, these people who are holding on to their mugs for $5 or better, they're just random. They didn't have the mugs 5 minutes ago. They didn't have any sentimental value. And yet they valued their mugs twice as highly as people who had not been given mugs.
So I didn't have this mug. I didn't care about this mug. But now that I have it.
Yeah, I'm not giving that mug up.
The discovery was that simply having a thing makes you overvalue that thing.
I ended up calling this the endowment effect.
Like that professor of Thaler's who wouldn't sell that $100 a bottle of wine? Endowment effect.
You got World Series tickets for face value. You know you could sell them to a scalper for $2,000. You go to the game anyway. Endowment effect.
So Thaler and Kahneman and Tversky and a few other people are doing more and more of these studies, finding more and more ways where people are predictably irrational. But it's still just a few people. You know, what they're doing is still pretty fringy. It's still basically outside of the mainstream of economics.
And then Richard Thaler gets this odd kind of break. There's a big new economics journal starting up. It's called the Journal of Economic Perspectives. And the editor calls up Thaler and he says, how about you write a column for us? You can write about the things that you and others are finding. And that column, called Anomalies, was when Richard Thaler and behavioral economics blew up.
His column was the best thing in Journal of Economic Perspectives.
Famous economist Tyler Cowen.
And the profession just got addicted to this. Every issue would come out. People would be talking about Thaler.
The other thing it did was it really grabbed the interest of undergrads like myself.
Famous economist Betsy Stevenson.
Or graduate students who were reading them and thinking, oh, okay, so I can ask these kinds of questions. What will that mean for my research?
Famous economist Greg Mankiw.
I don't think people appreciated at the time that this was going to open up a whole new field, and it has.
And also, famous economist Richard Thaler.
It's a soapbox.
Not only are you up on your soapbox, but people are gathering around to listen to you.
Yeah, yeah.
The column helped behavioral economics become a real thing. People were excited about it. But a lot of economists had a pretty reasonable criticism. A lot of these findings were coming from classroom experiments on college kids.
Like the mugs thing.
Sure. And so what does that really prove? Do these findings also hold up in the real world?
And Thaler was always looking for ways to test these ideas in the real world. Over time, he found more and more. One classic example came when he was spending a year in New York City.
Taking cabs around town and started talking to the cab drivers.
And he learns that the way this business works is that most drivers will rent the cab for 12 hours, and then it's up to them whether they want to work the whole 12 hours or knock off early.
And so Thaler and his colleagues start trying to figure out, how do the cab drivers sort of manage their day? How do they decide how long to work, when to knock off? And here's what they find. Very often, the cab drivers have some number in mind at the start of their day. They think like, okay, I need to make, say, $500 in my day today. And then when they hit that number, they stop.
So if that takes 6 hours and then they hit $500, they stop. If it takes all 12 hours, they work all 12 hours, and then they stop.
This means that they wind up working less, working shorter hours on the busy days, and they wind up working more, working longer hours on the slow days.
This is not at all what you would expect if they were going to follow basic economic principles.
If they were trying to maximize their hourly pay.
You know, go the full 11 and a half hours on the day you're raking it in and quit early on the day where there's nothing to be made.
And people are doing the exact opposite of that.
They're doing exactly the opposite.
Thaler called this behavior mental accounting. The taxi drivers are treating each day like it's a different account, like it's a separate bucket, and it doesn't matter what happened the day before or what's going to happen the day after. All that matters is the money that you're making today.
And we all do this kind of mental accounting in one way or another. You know, like a classic example might be you spend all year trying to pile up a few thousand dollars, couple thousand dollars in your savings account. And then one day your tax refund comes and you're like, yeah, free money, $2,000 tax refund. I'm going to take a trip. I'm going to buy a fancy watch.
No, that tax money is the same money. It's dollars. It counts the same towards everything. And yet we treat it differently. That is mental accounting.
So, okay, Thaler's done the classroom work, the mugs and stuff. He's done these real-world studies, like with the cab drivers. And eventually, he and other people in the field think to themselves, okay, now we know all of these ways that people sort of self-sabotage. Maybe we can set up the world, or at least kind of tweak little corners of it, to help people get what they want.
So one problem that Thaler noticed, people don't save enough money for retirement.
Which is literally news to no one.
But Thaler and his colleagues realized there might be some really easy things you could do to make it easier to save.
Yeah. So like when they started looking at this, it was typical when you started a job at a company with like a basic 401k retirement plan. You had to sign up. You know, you had to say, yeah, put some of my money in the thing. But most people did not sign up.
So Thaler and his colleagues said, all right, how about this? When you start a new job, you're automatically enrolled into the 401k. You're going to automatically start contributing. It's going to come right out of your paycheck. And if you don't want to contribute, that's fine. You're just going to have to fill out some paperwork and then no contribution. No big deal.
This had a huge effect. Lots more people started contributing. But this default opt-in contribution was very low.
Companies would start people off at a very low rate, like 3%.
Not enough.
Don't stop at 3%. So another one of my students, Shlomo Ben-Artzi, and I tried to figure out a solution to that, and we called it Save More Tomorrow.
It's great because it means I don't have to save more today, first of all. I'm already in.
Exactly.
Save More Tomorrow means that you start out at a low rate, but then when you get a raise down the road, you automatically start saving a bigger and bigger portion of your paycheck. And all these ideas about retirement, they took off.
Can I say, by the way, Bloomberg News just yesterday published a story that said some 68% of large U.S. companies now automatically enroll employees in 401k plans, and 3/4 of those employers bump up worker savings rates automatically every year.
That's it. That's behavioral economics in action.
These little tweaks, like changing the default option to opt-in and automatically contributing money, Thaler and one of his colleagues started calling these nudges. And people in power, they liked these ideas.
And all of a sudden, governments around the world were nudging their citizens. In the UK, the government created something that people started calling the Nudge Unit, which sounds like some, you know, bad band out of Seattle in 1995. But this group did figure out how to get more people to be organ donors. They got more people to pay their taxes on time.
In the US, President Obama set up his own Nudge Unit that helped low-income students enroll in college and helped veterans get access to more benefits and save more money for retirement. And Thaler says, as of today, around 75 countries have nudge units working on this stuff, trying to take the findings from this new field of behavioral economics and help us get the things we want.
I mean, what do you make of your career? Or what do you make of sort of the field that you've helped create? Whatever you want, just go big.
So, look, the economic theory can really be boiled down to two words: people optimize.
And define optimize?
Choose the best alternative they can afford.
What is your response to people optimize?
No, they don't. look at this.
And look over here. I got a mug to sell you.
Yeah, exactly. The idea that people have self-control problems and they don't know how to save for retirement and they know they should is news to no one except economists.
Yes.
That's the world we live in. And once you accept the realization that we are imperfect beings, then there are things you can do to help.
After the credits, hear Richard Thaler get the phone call after winning the Sveriges Riksbanks Alfred E. Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences.
Can you say it the right way? Do you know it?
What's the full? The full is Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Slack, used by companies all over the world to get everything done, where every part of work, from documents to decisions, is stored, archived, and searchable in seconds. Slack, where work happens. Find out why at slack.com.
Email us at planetmoney@npr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Today's episode was produced by Nick Fountain. Bryant Urstadt is our editor. Head of our Nudge Unit, Alex Goldmark. Special thanks this week to Richard Thaler's former student, Dean Carlin, and to Thaler's golf buddy, Eugene Fama.
If you're looking for something else to listen to, check out Up First. It's a podcast from the people who make Morning Edition. It comes out every day. You can listen to it. You can find out what's happening. And it's a podcast. You can listen to it whenever you want, wherever you are.
I'm Kenny Malone.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel to Richard H. Thaler for his contributions to behavioral economics.
This is from Monday, October 9th. It's 11:45 a.m. in Stockholm. It's 4:45 a.m. in Chicago, where Richard Thaler now teaches. He was at home. He'd gotten a heads up that he won the prize. And the Nobel Committee called him up again so he could talk to a room full of journalists in Sweden.
Hello, Dr. Thaler. This is Göran Hansen, the guy who woke you up an hour ago.
Good morning, Göran.
Have you had your cup of coffee now?
Yeah, I'm awake.
Very good. Do you have a question over there, please?
There's a substantial amount of money involved here in the prize. I'm wondering if you're going to be super rational about this money or if you will act humanly with the money in that case.
Well, you know, this is actually quite a funny question. I will say I will try to spend it as irrationally as possible.
Very good.